We're going to be continuing on in Mark. This morning, we're looking at another longer section again. It's going to be Mark chapter 8, verses 1 through 26. Mark chapter 8, and we'll start at the beginning. I'm just going to read about 10 of those verses to get us going, and we'll kind of come back and walk through it together. Mark chapter 8, verse 1 goes like this. In those days there was again a large crowd, and they had nothing to eat. He summoned the disciples and said to them, I have compassion on the crowd, because they've already stayed with me 3 days and have nothing to eat. If I send them home hungry, they will collapse on the way, and some of them will have come a long distance. His disciples answered him, Where can anyone get enough bread in this desolate place to fill these people? How many loaves do you have? He asked them. Seven, they said. Then he commanded the crowd to sit down on the ground. Taking 7 loaves, he gave thanks, broke the loaves, and kept on giving them to his disciples to sit before the people. So they served the loaves to the crowd. They also had a few small fish, and when he had blessed them, he said these were to be served as well. They ate and were filled. Then they collected 7 large baskets of leftover pieces. About 4,000 men were there. He dismissed them and immediately got into the boat with his disciples and went to the district of Dalmanutha. So let's go ahead and address the elephant in the room. If you're here probably a month or so ago, you heard a very similar story. And I want to let you off the hook and tell you, you're not crazy. You're not experiencing deja vu. In chapter 6, there's a very, very similar account, almost identical. And so we'll look at that, and what you can do is really flip back there and get a pen ready, because I'm going to give you a handful of similarities between these two stories, and it's incredible how much it patterns itself. This repetition reminds me of a Christian comedian named Michael Jr., and if you get a chance to YouTube him or look him up, he's pretty hilarious. But he tells this really funny story about how he wasn't a Christian. He went to church a little bit with his grandmother, but he had no familiarity with the Bible, with Jesus, really with church. He associated it with like funerals and stuff like that. And he knew about religion, but didn't know anything about Jesus. And somebody invited him to go to this church, and he was really moved, and he heard the preaching of the gospel and was like, man, I want to give my life to Jesus, but I need to make sure this isn't some kind of crazy religion or something first. I'll read the brochure. And so he made a deal with himself to read the brochure, and then he realized, man, that's a thick brochure. And so he started reading the Bible every day, and he said, I'm going to read this thing all the way through before I commit to anything. And he's in the airport. He doesn't have a Bible. He's in the airport. This random lady gives him a Bible. They don't even speak to each other. She just walks up and hands him this Bible. And he reads it, and he gets to Matthew, and he said, oh, man, I never knew Jesus died for my sins. Maybe in that preaching at the church, he might have heard something about that, but his whole life, no one ever told him that. He said, man, Jesus died for me. And he felt moved again, and he said, well, I need to keep reading. I told myself I would read the whole thing. So he gets to Mark, and he's like, man, they killed Jesus again. And he gets to Luke and John, and he's eventually like, no, Jesus, get out of the garden, get out of the garden. Get you. And nobody ever explained to him that it's 4 different accounts of the same story. And sometimes, you know, we all kind of know that. A lot of us have been raised in church. But repetition like this happens across the gospel. And it's a time when we can perk up our ears, you know, write notes in our Bible, like what's different between this one and, say, Luke's account of it, or what's similar between the two accounts. But also repetitions happen across the Gospels and then within each Gospel. You have multiple stories going on. Sometimes it's because it's a whole different story, and it'll be easy to spot. It'll say it's in a different location with different people. But sometimes it's not so easy to tell. With this one, we do know that it's different because Jesus later on distinguishes between the 2 miracles from chapter 6 to chapter 8. But one of the things we forget is that John said if he were to write down all the things Jesus did, there's not enough ink and pages in the world to tell of all he did. So you got to remember, this is like everyday life for the disciples, that Jesus just feeds crowds. That's just normal, normal activity that Jesus takes just a handful of food and distributes it among thousands of people. It's pretty amazing, really, if you look at it. And really, this one points us back to chapter 6, but in a minute we'll look at even in the Old Testament where it points back again. And I don't know if y'all remember these things called encyclopedias before, you know, the internet, but they had these cool things, and I went and borrowed the one we had in our home from my brother. They had these cool things, like this is the anatomy system, and they got these clear, like transparent pages like we used to use for the overhead projectors and stuff. And they've got, which you can tell our family used it, but you can tell it's all ripped, that one is like the skeletal system, but then on the backside it has like, you know, the brains, the central nervous system, and each one shows a different system. See that? It's just a part of it. But when you lay it over the other one, both from the front and the back, you see the whole picture. And so, you know, you get a clearer picture. And I'm going to make the case to you this morning that that's what the Bible does in general, but it's also what Jesus does specifically. He uses these miracles, these events, as ways to fulfill what was spoken about him before. He also uses them himself to prophesy of what will happen in the future. So let's look at chapter 6. And I'm going to give you six different things. These come from David Akin. He's some kind of scholar. But I think he's Southeastern Baptist or Theological Seminary, something along those lines. But I really like the way he uses these headings. And it just makes it really simple for us. And I'll give you the verse, so maybe what you could do is write down the coordinating verse from chapter 8 in 6 or vice versa. Number one, the first similarity we have is a feeding of a great multitude. And that's found both in chapter 6, verses 30 to 44, and then again in Mark 8, 1 through 9, what we just read. So you could put feeding or feeding the crowd, feeding of a great multitude. That's 6:30 through 44 and 8, 1 through 9. Then you have a boat trip. Both of them have this boat trip. That's in chapter 6, verses 45 through 56. And then again in chapter 8, verse 10, what we ended with. And if I'm going too fast, y'all just give me the pump the brake signal and I'll repeat. Number three, so we got a feeding of a great multitude, a boat trip. Number three is confrontation with the Pharisees. And that's in chapter 7, verses 1 through 23. But you find it almost identical again in chapter 8, verses 11 through 13. So feeding of a great multitude, boat trip, showdown with the confrontations or with the Pharisees or confrontation. And then a conversation about bread. That's in chapter 7, verses 24 through 30, or in chapter 8, verses 14 through 21. And if you notice, both of these are just going where the last section picked up is picking up on that next verse and carrying on to the next one in both chapters. So you got a feeding of a great multitude, a boat trip, confrontation with the Pharisees, a conversation about bread, and then a miraculous healing. We'll get to that later, but for now, that's in chapter 7, verses 31 through 36. And then in chapter 8, verses 22 through 26. And if y'all need me to screenshot these and text them to somebody or something like that, that'd be fine too. I know it's a lot of writing here. And then finally, what we won't read in chapter 8 today, what all this is building to, is a significant confession. And it's just one verse in chapter 8. You find it in chapter 7, verse 37, and then again in chapter 8 and verse 27. So 7:37 and 8:27. So you can see 6 major events, like the way the whole story unfolds, verse to verse, section to section, this is very, very similar to chapter 8 and what we're going to look at today. But it also, I'm going to have you doing a lot of flipping today, it also takes us all the way back to Exodus. So if you'll find Exodus for me, chapter 16, it points us back there, and I don't think you'll see it as a stretch. What you can do, again, is just write down the corresponding, like a keyword, and then maybe 8. I just wrote Mark 8 by mine, but maybe you can write the verses if you want. But I find at least 4 similarities between this manna account and both chapter 6 and chapter 8. And I'll just read through it. I'm not going to read the whole chapter. I'll jump around a little bit. But you just, in your translation, you find the right words to underline, and I'll kind of stop there. The entire Israelite community departed from Elim and came to the wilderness of Sin, which is between Elim and Sinai. On the 15th day of the second month, after they had left the land of Egypt, so this is just after being enslaved, verse 2 says, the entire Israelite community grumbled against Moses and Aaron in the wilderness. So you can highlight, circle, underline the entire Israelite community and in the wilderness. And when you see it again over here in verse 1 of chapter 10, when there was a large crowd and they had nothing to eat. And then further down, you'll see verse 4. Where can anyone get enough bread in this desolate place to feed these people? So you got a desolate place, a lot like the wilderness, except this one is by the sea, and then you have a large crowd in it. Now, next we skip to hunger. Come down to Exodus 16, verse 3. The Israelites said to them, if only we had died by the Lord's hand in the land of Egypt, when we sat by pots of meat and ate all the bread we wanted. Instead, you brought us into the wilderness to make this whole assembly die of hunger. So that's, again, right at the beginning. It's all throughout chapter 8, verse 1 through 10. Hungry, you know, they have nothing to eat. And if you'll remember here, they're also bemoaning the fact that they just got freed from slavery. That's going to be key later on when we're looking. Skip down again to verse 8. It says, Moses continued, the Lord will give you meat to eat this evening and more than enough bread in the morning. So he gives them quail and manna. And if you take time later on to read this quote, it'll remind you of like back in February. They wake up and they see this stuff covering the ground, kind of like we saw the snow, you know. And they're like, what in the world is this? And Moses knew it was coming and told them, you know, you gather up the manna and eat that, and the night before you'll have the quail. Much like in our account, we have bread and fish. Now, it's not quail, but it's what would have been in a desolate place by a river. So still, again, very similar, bread and meat. And then skip way on down to verse 27. It says, yet on the seventh day, some of the people went out to gather, but they did not find any. So you can just circle seventh or seventh day, because it goes into a whole, from there on out, a whole section about the observation of the Sabbath, of the seventh day of rest. And that whole part leading up to that was saying, hey, he's going to give you manna, but he's going to give you enough manna that on the sixth day, you gather what you need, and on the seventh, you won't have to go out and gather. In fact, there won't be anything to gather. So this is a key principle here we need to remember. God's provision is directly connected, directly linked with his rest. It's actually part of his rest. When he provides food, when he provides sustenance, he also provides a way for you to rest. You know, we tend to think that the way we provide is God gives us the ability to work and to provide, and that's true. But he gave us a pattern in the Sabbath day of rest, where he didn't need rest, but we need his rest. And we're actually more effective on those other 6 days. So God's provision and rest are linked to this miraculous feeding. Now we barreled off into this, seeing how it went back to chapter 6, seeing how it goes back to chapter 16 of Exodus. But what's the big picture here? Because we got several different parts. So skip back to me, with me to Mark chapter 8. And we'll look at kind of the way it's set up, but we won't discuss a lot of the content. For one, you've discussed a lot of similar content in chapter 6, very similar. But also, too, I think Mark's main point here is not just in the content, but in the way that it's put together. So we'll look at repetition and fulfillment and how Jesus calling back to chapter 6 and even back to the Old Testament helps him fulfill what was said of him, helps him fulfill his promises, but also the repetition of this story, of this event, is leading us to something that will be fulfilled in the future as well. So why are these stories put together? First of all, what are the stories we have here? There's four sections, three stories, two dialogues, two miracles. A lot of numbers, I know. So there's four sections, three stories, two dialogues, and two miracles. I know it sounds crazy because it doesn't really add up. But remember like a month or so ago when I talked to you about intercalations? Does anyone remember that? The kids were writing it down. It's a story sandwich, which Mark uses all the time. And he'll use an event, he'll tell the story of an event and interrupt in the middle of that, not only because that's how Jesus did it, but and operated in real life, but he tells the story of what happened in the middle to highlight the similarities in what Jesus was revealing about himself. So it's a story sandwich. We got one of those in this section. We also have a triad. So these are some of the, I guess you could call them technical terms, but there are some things that Mark uses that we're not really used to as English readers. And a triad is just what it sounds like. It's three stories lumped together. And Mark Strauss, another scholar, points out that usually when Mark does these triads, lumps them together like that, it's because he's showing something about or emphasizing the unbelief of the disciples. Not of Pharisees, not of the crowds necessarily, but more about the disciples and their failure to see what Jesus is up to. So the first story is the feeding. It's a big one. Then we have an interruption in verse 11. So they leave the scene and we enter the boat with them and go into the next scene because they're in a whole different place. They got a whole different crowd and it's the Pharisees. They have this confrontation that only lasts three verses. And then you're in verse 14 and you're resolving that story. So that's the sandwich. The top bun is Jesus feeding all these people, bread and fish and them having leftovers. The meat or the fish in the sandwich is the Pharisees confronting Jesus. And the bottom bun is Jesus explaining to the disciples, why are you worrying? You saw me back in chapter 6 fulfill this with 12 baskets left over. You saw me again in chapter 8 right now, like minutes ago, do the same thing and you had 7 baskets left over. Why are you worried? And so that's the bottom bun. But then we have this other thing. It pairs real well with it. Sorry I relate everything to food. But you got bread, fish, bread, and then you have some other side that pairs really good, and that's the healing of a blind man. And so when you're reading through this for the first time, you might say, you know, that Sesame Street game, like one of these things does not belong. Which one of them is it? Well, it would be the healing of the blind at first sight. But we're going to see some of those key questions Jesus asked the disciples is what links that last section together with the healing of the blind man. And it's all building to a significant proclamation, a confession that Jesus is who he says he is, he's Lord. So let's take them section by section and see how they're connected, how they fit together like a puzzle. And again, it's a triad and an intercalation working together. So a sandwich with a third side on it. Miracle 1 is also section 1. And this big second miraculous feeding in Mark. And we just read that, so we won't read through it again. But we do need to notice some things about it. Jesus is giving a miracle in abundance to have leftovers. I mean, not only did he fulfill everyone, they ate till they were full, but they had 7 baskets left over. That's incredible. And notice how it all started. It's all preceded and based upon and even done out of, completed, accomplished by Jesus' love for the crowd. He sees them and has compassion on them. Think about how intently and intentionally he's looking at them. He's saying, he's even thinking about their journey home, about how they got there, about the scenarios in which they may faint. He's really focused on the crowd. Not about, I wonder how much applause they can give me. I wonder how much of this teaching they'll actually put to use. His focus is, what value can I add to them? I can't leave them hungry. I'm giving them the bread of life, but I also have to give them physical bread. So he initiates everything, and it's all out of his goodness. And he looks on their physical state. He has compassion and pity. And again, so abundantly that there are 7 leftovers. And there's no mistake. Jesus is showing them and us that his provision is complete. It's more than enough, more than what we could ever ask for. We rest in his work, not ours. You know, they're satisfied by what he did. He didn't say, okay, for the next 30 minutes, y'all go out and forage in this desolate place and see what you can get for each of your families. No, he says, what we have here seems like it's not enough, but I'm going to fill it to overflowing. So we need to recognize also that Jesus looked on us with compassion, that he met us where we were, that he saw what was physically there, and while it looked like it's not enough in our eyes, he provided in abundance. He took himself and dispersed it to us. The Holy Spirit empowers us not to work and to trust in him. He even gives us the strength and the faith to trust in his work. Not only does he accomplish all of it, but he helps us believe in it. He helps us understand it. So even though they saw this great miracle, the disciples struggled to rest in his provision. I mean, they just saw him feed 5,000. Now they see him feed 4,000. And by the way, we're just counting men, so it's probably almost triple that amount in both scenarios. And they leave the scene, have a tiny little altercation, and have forgotten that fast that Jesus provided. But I can think of a scenario just like a few weeks ago where our air conditioner went out. We had to get an indoor unit. And I forgot that Jesus provided in the first place for us to have a home. And I started worrying about how I was going to do it, how I was going to make ends meet, how we were going to take what we can see in front of us and make that spread. And God, just like he provided the home, provided a friend who would do the work. And of course we still paid, but he made the way. And how quickly had I forgotten? We moved in there in Thanksgiving, and here we are a couple months later. Sounds a lot like the disciples. We're really easy to forget how Jesus provides for us, both physically and spiritually. I mean, think about how he meets us in our sins. Like, he saves us from that life. We were pursuing death. We weren't even, like, seeking after God. And he put his spirit in us and wooed us to himself. The scriptures say he actually wooed us, called us to himself. Let's not be quick to forget. Let's rest in his provision and see how those things are connected. You know, Mark, his favorite word, his favorite transition word is immediately. So he ends his section with, and immediately they got into the boat with his disciples and went into the district of the D word. Sorry, I don't know Greek so great. And he So he leaves that scene and we enter this next one, which is a confrontation with the Pharisees. And we'll just read that short section real quick. I'll start at 10 because it kind of really starts there and brings us to the little back and forth. So it says, "And immediately they got into the boat with his disciples and went into the district of D. The Pharisees came out and began to argue with him, demanding of him a sign from heaven to test him. But sighing deeply in his spirit, he said, 'Why does this generation demand a sign? I assure you, no sign will be given to this generation.' Then he left them, got on board the boat again, and went to the other side." Notice the irony here. They're coming up and demanding a sign from Jesus, and he literally just got in the boat from having done one of the bigger miracles we know about, having fed 4,000. And they're demanding a sign. Mark uses irony a lot, and that's something to look out for in your own reading as you're reading through this. He takes these scenarios and contrasts them where somebody unknowingly or unwittingly confesses Jesus as Lord, maybe in a mocking way, but in reality what they're doing is proclaiming truth. And he uses those situations a lot. But isn't it funny that he doesn't say, "Hey, why don't you get in this boat right here we're in and go ask everybody in that desolate place over there. Ask everyone on that side of the wilderness, 4,000 plus people, if I can give a sign or not." It didn't even cross his mind, it seems like. That would be the first thing we would do. Like, are you kidding me? You want a sign for me? I just did that. But it's almost like it doesn't even cross Jesus' mind to do that. He instead goes to the heart of the problem, which is their heart. And he confronts their heart, because it's not really about him. His presence, him entering the scene in the first place, is what's making them wrestle with this, because he truly is God, and his presence demands some sort of response, either a revelation that it's truly God, which leads to worship, or scorn and unbelief. And often when people are asking for signs, it's got less to do with what their response will be and what their response is already decided in their heart. Jesus knew he could have gave them a sign if he wanted to. He could have even told them to go check on that. But he also knew they would find a way to reason out of it anyway. They don't believe in him in the first place. So they'll find a reason to say, "Well, we didn't have it on video, and you don't know what people can do with videos these days, so I don't know if I trust the media." I don't know if they really had seven loaves or a few fish. I don't know if I believe that. So he knew, and we do that same thing too. We doubt even after we've seen, or we doubt what we hear about, instead of giving glory to God that he's provided in abundance for our brother or our sister. But, you know, it's a lose-lose scenario for if Jesus enters into that conversation anyway. You know, they're not going to be convinced all of a sudden that he's Christ. They're not going to be convinced that he can give a sign. They've seen a bunch of signs. They've heard a bunch of signs for themselves already. And it's an interruption in the story, which is why I kind of included it as its own section, its own dialogue, because the Pharisees weren't there. You know, they really weren't there. And they're in a whole different place in the boat. But it's so connected because Jesus uses that conversation to lead right into what he'll talk about with the disciples. He overhears them arguing, fussing, worrying, you know, having anxiety like a lot of us do. And we'll pick that up in verse 14. It says, "They had forgotten to take bread and had only one loaf with them in the boat. Then he commanded them, 'Watch out, beware of the yeast of the Pharisees and the yeast of Herod.'" And that's something I really encourage you to dig into more, but again, we're looking more today at how they're connected. "They were discussing among themselves that they did not have any bread. Aware of this, he said to them," and Jesus gives a list of questions here that are really kind of confrontational. They're really confronting what's going on in their hearts. "Why are you discussing that you do not have any bread? Don't you understand or comprehend? Is your heart hardened? Do you have eyes and yet not see? And do you have ears and not hear?" That's a really significant part there, the blindness and being able to see. having eyes and being able to see? And do you not remember when I broke the five loaves for the 5,000? How many baskets full of pieces of bread did you collect? 12, they told him. When I broke the seven loaves for the 4,000, how many large baskets full of pieces of bread did you collect? 7, they said. And he said to them, don't you understand yet? I mean, you know, come on. I just fed all them. I just fed you. And in fact, he even uses like the numerology thing. And I know people get way out left field with this. But hear me out. 7 is significant. It was significant because it also linked us back to Exodus 16 and the Sabbath, the number of completion, all that. But it's also significant in this case, and Jesus is pointing it out to them because the first miracle, he did 12, almost as if to say, I'm going to provide for my children, the lost sheep of Israel, each and every tribe, and also for his new kingdom that he set up with each of the 12 disciples. So I've provided so much in abundance that each one of you took a basket home. Every single one of you right now who's worrying about this took a basket, a full basket home after feeding those thousands. Then he does the same miracle again, like moments ago, and you've forgotten again. And this time I've done 7. I've done enough. I've completed the work so that you could rest. We're in a boat. Take a nap, you know. He's done it all. And he points out the differences in those two stories. And Mark shows us this because, for one, it would be kind of confusing. Wait, he just fed 5,000, now he's feeding 4,000. So he helps us distinguish between it. But also, Jesus is using it in this conversation to show them, not only am I going to establish my kingdom because I am God incarnate, but I'm going to also provide rest for you. I'm going to make a way for you to enter into my kingdom. Because remember, the key principle we're working with is that God's provision is directly linked to his rest. I'll give you everything you need, and I'll give you the rest to be able to enjoy it all. So that's kind of the end of the sandwich, the discussion about the first feeding. And then we enter the third story, starting in verse 22, and that'll carry us down to 26, the end of that section. And this is the one, you know, it's kind of significant. It kind of brings a twist for us, because you can see how those others are connected. Even the dialogue is connected to the miracle. But this is just seems like it could be a miracle standing all by itself. It says, then they came to Bethsaida. They brought a blind man to him and begged him to touch him. He took the blind man by the hand and brought him out of the village, spitting on his eyes and laying his hands on him. He asked him, do you see anything? He looked up and said, I see people. They look to me like trees walking. Again, Jesus placed his hands on the man's eyes and he saw distinctly. He was cured and could see everything clearly. Then he sent him home saying, don't even go to the village. Now, the next verse is significant. I encourage you to read that, but again, we're confining ourselves to this part today. Don't even go to the village is kind of our ending point there. This is a strange story. You know, usually Jesus could do this miracle in a lot of different ways. And he does. He heals blind people all throughout the Gospels. He could just say it and the person be blind. He could blow, you know, like some of the televangelists do. He could blow and they would be healed. He could think it. He could touch them. He chooses to spit. I'm not going to pretend to know the significance of why he does that. I think it's pretty strange. But I also think it's pretty awesome. Everything Jesus does is different from what's expected. Some people have, theories as to why that's significant, and I encourage you to look into that if you want. But if you'll notice here, the first verse, then they came to Bethsaida, that they has changed. That's what brings us into a new story. It's a new audience. This time it's not just it's not the Pharisees anymore. It's not just the disciples, but it's presumably a crowd who brought this blind man, at least the blind man we know. And remember how crafty Mark gets with the storytelling. Like, he links these things together pretty intricately. And these two questions at the end. I don't know about y'all, but my Bible highlights them. Verse 18 is highlighted. It says, do you have ears or bolden? Do you have eyes and not see? And do you have ears and not hear? Jesus is saying, are you blind? And those two questions connect section 3 with section 4 here in a significant way. And Jesus, again, he distinguishes in section 3 between the first miracle and the second miracle. Here he gives a partial healing and then a full healing. The guy can only see blurred. And he's, in a way, he's showing the disciples, this is how it was when I fed the 5,000. You could see that I provide, but you couldn't see the whole picture. You didn't see why I had 12 leftover baskets. You easily and quickly forgot. You even forgot when I provided again for the 4,000, and you had 7. And so the same way this miracle happens twice back to back, it's connected to this healing of the blind back to back, because he heals partially, and then he heals fully to the point that they can see. And it's not that, again, Jesus' work is complete. It's more than enough. It's not that Jesus couldn't heal the man all at once. He's making a point to the disciples. And he's making that same point to us. Why are these lumped together like this? I think this is the key part of this whole passage right here. Do you have eyes and not see? Are we blinded to what God is doing, to what Jesus has miraculously done in our lives already? He's still saying to us today, remember when I did this for my glory and your good? Remember when I stepped in and intervened? Remember how vast is my goodness? How I looked on you and had compassion, just like I looked on those crowds. And I noticed that you were hungry. You didn't initiate this, I initiated it, and I look compassionately on you. Remember, my provision brings rest. Have you not seen fully? Yes, I've opened your eyes, but how quickly have you forgotten? And Jesus is again telling us today, he'll open our eyes to see his fullest, to see not just his fullness, but his work and his rest that he gives to us. So how do we apply these two questions? It's what we have to deal with today, really. Remember, we started way back in Exodus and looked at Exodus and both Mark chapter 6 and Mark chapter 8. And I said there was like a repetition and fulfillment theme that we would come back to. Well, Jesus pulls back on the past and fulfills those more fully. You know, manna was pointing to the children. They were lost, the children of Israel, and now they're still lost. Even his disciples, in a way, are lost and quickly forgetting all the miracles, much like the Israelites did all throughout the Old Testament. And again, we've pointed out how we do the same. But Jesus was not only pulling on the past, he was pointing to the future. And we know that shortly after this, according to the other Gospels, Jesus would frequently say things that kind of sound morbid, like, if you want to follow me, you're going to have to eat my body and drink my blood. And it caused people to totally just leave, turn around and walk away. And we know that's metaphorical in a way. And so we kind of like smooth over that. But for them, it was really disgusting. Like, what, we're going to become cannibals? And the early church, even after, you know, the completion of the Bible, all the stories we know about the churches there, the early church was made fun of for this communion thing, because they used that as a way to commemorate what Jesus did. And 3.5 years, somewhere in that span, Jesus ended his ministry by completing the work and completing it to abundance. And he did it by becoming that fish and that bread. And his body was broken. He was betrayed, arrested. His flesh was ripped apart. Think about our Savior for a minute, the God of the universe who created everything. Not only is his beard plucked out and his head swollen and his body bleeding, but he's paraded naked in public. Jesus Christ. In front of kids. In front of his mom. Just contemplate that. The weight of that shame. The God of the universe being poured out like that. And then his blood was spilled until he breathed his last breath for us. To the point that those that even reject him, who don't come to worship him, have an opportunity. That's how sufficient his work on the cross was. So he pointed forward. And he even pointed forward to a day when we'll be gathered around the throne. The Bible begins with this theme, really, with a meal, with a feeding. And it's where sin is brought into the world in the garden. But it ends in a much more glorious picture, where we get to join with Jesus in something called the marriage supper of the Lamb. And we celebrate our new life in him, our new family in him.